True Brot, 1970. Over here, you. Icelandic prog rock. Undir Arifum, name of the album from which we heard Going. Tomb before that, T-O-M-B, Luciferian homage. Portions of that new album entitled Zessi. I guess, with an X in the front. Melmac before that, the album and the track entitled Le Désert Avance. Mueran Humanos, their self-titled full-length LP, Alter Hogar, the track we heard. We heard Roberto Cacciapalli with Ann Steele on the Ann Steele record called the Ann Steele Album. The song was My Time. Before that, King Kong, Old Man on the Bridge from Old Man on the Bridge. David Kilgour and the Heavy Eights, new music from him. CD is called Left by Soft, so was the song. We open that set with the Vandells covering The Spaceman 3, Losing Touch with My Mind. The CD is called Summer Fling, and that's everything we heard. My name is Scott. Maybe I'll see you next week. Maybe not, I haven't figured that out yet. You're tuned to Freeform Radio, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, worldwide, WFMU. .org. Stay tuned for Benjamin Walker and Too Much Information. Goodbye!
Read my books or at least saw me naked in some glossy magazines. Anyway, today I'd like to share with you some sex advice about how to take a dirty picture. Well, if you are dreaming to make some naughty, dirty photo shooting with your nude girlfriend, just follow some simple rules. First of all, never have sex before photo shooting, because during sex your girl will lose all her makeup and her hairdo, and she'll lose all her sex appeal, so please, wait till the shooting is over. The second thing is, please, leave all your criticism behind. Just prepare the best compliments you know for your girlfriend and keep telling her how gorgeous she is, how hot body she has, and how much you want her. This will be very supportive and it will make her feel more confident, so she'll act better, much better, trust me. The last but not least thing, please, no pressure. If your girlfriend is ready to lose all her clothes and get absolutely naked, that's great. But if she's not, please let her keep her underwear at least.
How you are and how you live your life is kind of portrayed in your face. That's what I think.
Steve Pike's been photographing the human face for over 30 years now.
I'm kind of known for photographing portraits and collections of portraits, like artists, film directors and writers. I photographed all the guys that walked on the moon. Most of the time what I do is I self-generate projects whereby I actually kind of go after a particular group, a particular family of people.
The philosopher is another type that Steve Pike likes to chase after. Oxford University Press has just published his second book of philosopher portraits. I stopped by Pike's studio in Lower Manhattan to talk about this project and find out how one begins a study of philosophers.
About 25 years ago, I was asked to photograph the great British philosopher Sir A.J. Eyre, who was a very public figure in England. He was always the person that was on the TV if they wanted like somebody to talk about the morality of a sort of some social situation. He'd come onto TV and he'd talk about it. So he was a public intellectual. He was the heir apparent to Bertrand Russell. So I went to photograph him. No idea. I mean, I'm not an academic. I'm not a philosopher. And so I went to photograph him in North London and like worrying a little bit about like, you know, what we could possibly have in common. Yeah, but I shouldn't have worried at all because I was supposed to be there for like 10 minutes and I was there for 4 hours.
If you're a regular listener of Too Much Information, you know by now that I really like talking to photographers on the radio. And I know that must be at times frustrating for you, dear listener. But this takes it to a whole new level because I'm now on the radio talking about photographs of philosophers. I'm sorry, but please just bear with me.
His face had so much character, you know, to just, in lots of ways, I think you earn your face. And Ayres earned a pretty interesting one here.
I know this is going to sound dumb, but I find it impossible not to look for physical representations of philosophical genius writ large on the faces of Jacques Derrida, Jürgen Habermas, Richard Rorty, C.L.R. James, Karl Popper, and all the other great minds who've sat for Steve Pike over the years. But of course, it doesn't work that way.
But people say, well, you know, is there a type? You know, is there like a type of face? And of course there's not. I mean, you could take Eyre and say that he was a historian or that he was, you know, that he'd worked on the dustbins for the last, like, 40 years. And you wouldn't necessarily know that that wasn't true. What's happened, the reason that they become a family is because they're put in this collection. Because you then look at it and you know, that's what this is. It's a family tree.
Steve Pike says he got the idea for this project that afternoon when he was in Eyre's office. He said he asked the great man for his list of top 10 philosophers.
He gave me three names. I'll tell you what he did. He opened this little notebook, which had all this, because, you know, this is pre-email, pre-digital, pre-anything, you know, and he had like a little notebook this size. It was like the size of my palm. And he opened it up and it was full of like little bits of minute writing. And full of little bits of like cards and things that he'd stuck in, stamps and stuff like that, with writing on them. And this was his address book. So he goes, he opens the address book, and he says, I'll give you three names. He gave me Isaiah Berlin and his phone number. He gave me Michael Dummett and his phone number. And he gave me Peter Strawson and his phone number. And these are like three, at that time I didn't know, but they're three heavyweights, three real heavyweights. So what I did within the month was to go and see those people and to go and photograph them and ask them who their 10 were, and they gave me 10 names. Because I come from this editorial background, I was thinking of the idea of like there was a top 10 of philosophers, which is like a ludicrous notion. I realize that now.
It turns out that Steve Pike doesn't read philosophy.
I read all the time, but I don't read philosophy. I mean, I realized that wasn't actually my role in all this. I understood what my place was within this quite early on, and that was to make a visual record of a family of people which are really, really important, and that a lot of the time are quite happy with the fact that they're not. I think quite a lot of the time that they're not being noticed a lot of the time. They can get on with what it is that they really want to do, which is to think and to put their work together. What I've learned from studying philosophers is that I've become a sociologist of that practice. I can physically close my eyes and I can see a family tree with many branches on it, all these different areas of philosophy, and I can see the way that these people that are now more toward the root have you know, further down the tree, have spread out their fingers and have contacted and made happen all these other different areas and change philosophy, which is always completely changing all the time, and has changed it through the people basically that dug them.
Steve Pike still asks everyone he shoots for their top 10 list of philosophers. So even though there are now two books, he has no plans on stopping. This tree of philosophers, he says, will continue to grow.
I don't see what you photograph if you're really caught up in it. You know, it's anything you put down. I've only got one project which I can put down, the astronauts, because, you know, I ran out of people to photograph. But I don't see that, you know, that you're engaged with something. Why would you stop? It's like, you know, retirement. I mean, you know, it's not an option.
I recommend you pick up Steve Pike's new book before it goes out of print. His first volume of Philosophers is difficult to find. Of course, you can locate one online, but I assure you, it's not cheap. And that is the problem with photography books. They are just so damn expensive. And once you start, you can't stop. It's worse than a drug habit, because photography books are also very, very heavy. The last time I moved, it was 36 boxes. There are just so many photography books I need to have. It's really the only reason I want to be rich one day, so I can afford to buy them all. Perhaps I should just build myself a webpage and solicit photographers and publishers to send me free books like the photographer Alex Soth does on his website. But like I said, it's a habit. Why tempt the monkey? Alex Soth is one of the three photographers I featured in the miniseries I did on the Tea Party in America last year, Beyond the Fruited Plain. You can still find those in the TMI archive. They're not out of print. But tonight, I present you these three interviews together. First, we hear from Richard Mizrach, then Alex Soth, and then Naomi Harris. Three distinct visions of America. In the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, photographer Richard Mizrach wandered the deserted streets of New Orleans with his cameras.
It became more like a post-apocalyptic movie. You know, it felt like that. These are the kind of things you expect to see when the end of the world happens.
Richard Mizrach spent weeks photographing the disaster, but he didn't rush to publish his photos as others did. He put the work away for almost 5 years.
I actually was going to put it away for longer, but I felt that, you know, basically people had already started to forget about Katrina. And I thought maybe the five-year anniversary was a good time to sort of introduce some of the work. And I went back through 3,000 negatives, and one small portion of that large shoot popped out of me, and that was the photographs of people's messages in spray paint and charcoal and pencil, whatever they could find on their homes and cars and trees. And I felt like for the first time I heard the people's voices, the people that the survivors or the rescue workers, people that were on the ground. And it made me very self-conscious, if you will, of the fact that whether it's a Spike Lee film or a Robert Polidori photograph or all these other important, really, really important documents and treatments of Katrina, that there was always an editorial component that sort of overshadowed everything. There was always the voice of the artist or the filmmaker or the writer. And I found this to be an opportunity to let people speak for themselves for the first time. It sort of jumped out at me. And when I was going through the pictures, I noticed that there was a narrative just laying there in front of me just to organize and represent to the public. So the the first body of work that I released from that whole series that I photographed was that body of work for that very reason.
The book is called Destroy This Memory, and Richard Mizrach goes to great lengths to let the images speak for themselves. There are no essays, no captions.
There's no page numbers, there's no titles. I really wanted just the words that people wrote to do all the work. So the book opens actually with a photograph, and all it is on the side of a building, somebody wrote help with exclamation points twice, help, help. I mean, what would it take for somebody to write on their home with spray paint a message to some unknown presence? I mean, it's pretty strange and powerful sort of act of, I don't know, despair or hope or fear or sort of more, maybe more existential, just sort of just communicating with the universe.
A number of the messages Richard Mizrach photographs reference the dead. Some are chilling, like possible body, and some are simple. RIP signs on houses and fences for Zach, G. Perkins, and Thomas Burke, a.k.a. Tab. A number of these death notices, though, refer to animals.
Tens of thousands of pets were left behind when the storm hit, and many of them died. Many of them perished. People were not able to come back in time. And I think the most important, maybe the key photograph for me from this series is the one that says 9-30, September 30th, SPCA, 2 DOA, K9. Here you have this really economical code of just cold, simple information that lets you know that two dogs were dead on arrival and the SPCA was there. And when I saw that, I was just like, that made me feel that there was something going on with these messages. They're so economical in their use of words that they're almost like poetry, but without being, trying to be arty, not without trying to be poetic. Part of it is too, is a lot of these messages, you're not quite sure who they're written to. They're almost like text messages, but more primitive.
In some of the messages Richard Mizrach photographs, you can make out who the recipients are. These are the angry messages. Richard Mizrach finds a lot of anger in New Orleans.
There was this anger towards FEMA and Bush, those, you know, political anger. And then one of the things that I found very interesting was the anger towards the insurance companies, which hasn't been covered that much. And I thought that that was really important because a lot of people brought it up. When I first got to the Gulf Coast, somebody told me that, you know, if you had flood insurance, then the insurance companies would say, well, the damage was caused by the wind. And if you had like hurricane or storm insurance, they said, well, it was caused by water. And the insurance companies just, you know, bent over backwards not to fulfill the claims because, frankly, there was probably so much of it, they probably couldn't. So they had to find ways to get out. And so people were really, really angry. And you could see that in the photographs, too. Again, their words say it all. I got by Allstate. I think that's really powerful. The guy was so angry, he didn't have time to add the ED to, you know. The message comes across. I noticed that there's all these different ranges of emotions people went through. There was even, you know, a gallows humor, which was really powerful and sort of showed the resilience of the New Orleans. I found that really very, very uplifting in some ways that people could find this kind of humor. Even, there's things that are unintentionally humorous where there's a car on top of a boat and the boat owner puts a nice little note to the car owner to please remove his car carefully so he doesn't damage the boat. There's a house that had been lifted up and set in the middle of the road. And then, if you look really carefully in the background, you can see that there's a car that's actually been lifted up and put on top of a fence. And then somebody had the wherewithal to write Wicked Witch with an arrow pointing down at the ground on the side of the house. And they actually put boots and leggings that look like a Wicked Witch's. And so somebody, I don't know who went to all that trouble, but and who they were doing it for, but people were able to sort of find some humor to sort of deal with it. And it's amazing that humor can really help there. And it was not only, yeah, obviously it worked for them, but it was messages sent out to the world. Something I think that's so affecting about these images for me, and this is why I photographed them, is that even the spray paint, people's personality comes through in the painting, in the actual way they're painting. Like this is a good example, or the cover Destroy This Memory, which is written in cursive. I mean, it's very painterly with people not trying to make art, not trying to be, you know, expressive. They're just they're just literally just sending a message with paint, and it's very effective. You know, it's so again, these are just existential. I mean, to have the wherewithal to write "destroy this memory" in cursive on your home after a disaster like this, I mean, who would write that? What do they mean? And I love the ambiguity. I also love the fact that that's got a sort of a double entendre. It's very much about photography, and you know, on one hand, it's saying we want to forget this. On the other hand, I think it's so important for photography to preserve this chapter in Katrina history.
There is something shocking about the images in "Destroy This Memory," because as much as we live in a moment where everyone supposedly can get their voice heard, these raw messages suggest otherwise. In fact, these messages are stark reminders of just how rare it is to hear the actual voice of the people, rather than some media or political construct. Of course, there are a few pictures in the book where Richard Mizrach calls attention to himself as a photographer, especially if you're familiar with his work, but there is one sequence where he deliberately makes himself known. He shoots the same message 3 times, a close-up, a medium shot, and a long shot.
Yeah, that was very conscious. I wanted to break up the flow a little bit and just have the viewers stop for a second and think about, oh, you know, the pictures sort of mediate all this. And it's very subtle, but it was important to me.
I don't know if you can call the message subtle. The message is, f*** you.
Yeah, I mean, actually, originally the cover was going to be the first f*** you. In fact, I don't think my publisher was sort of challenging me on that, but what you're looking at is it's a side, we don't know what it is, it's very abstract, but somebody wrote, I can't tell if it's pencil or charcoal, you know, just you, and it looks like a side of a wall or something. As you pull back, you realize it's the side of a semi-trailer, I think, and you see it in the landscape with a, you know, cribs and a home, and I even think that's Bert or Ernie, actually I can't tell, yeah, I think it's Ernie. Ernie's in the crib, and you see no context of the larger storm. But originally, I liked, you know, the close-up of the "f*** you" for the book, because it's, again, it's almost an existential "f*** you." It's like, who is that addressed to? Is that to the government? Is that to the insurance companies? Is that to God? Is that, you know, it's just hard to or to a neighbor. I mean, I like the ambiguity of that. I felt like this whole experience was one big "f*** you."
I was at this dinner party in Rome a while ago, and I was sitting next to a poet from New York. It was at the American Academy in Rome, and she asked where I live, and I said Minnesota, and she was completely flabbergasted. Like, just, she was like, how is it possible you haven't moved? As though I'm living, you know, on the prairie or something. And it's so corny, but I mean, this is a huge chunk of America, and it is worthwhile space. I mean, it's there are a lot of nuances and a lot of interesting things out here.
Alex Soth still lives and works in the town he grew up in, Minneapolis, Minnesota, and he's probably the most famous contemporary American photographer who doesn't live on the East or West Coast. Last year, the Walker Arts Center in Minneapolis celebrated its native son with a giant career retrospective, an exhibit called From Here to There, Alex Soth's America. When I got the catalog in the mail, I kind of laughed because Alex Soth once wrote in his blog how much he hates photo books that use America in the title. Books like American Surfaces, in the American West, American Monument, American Musicians, Model American, American Color,
right.
The American.
I guess in that case, I'm talking about personal projects. I mean, this is a collaborative event, doing a survey exhibition like this. And there was a lot of discussion about the title of this. But with my own projects, you know, Sleeping by the Mississippi, I make that up. That's my call. An exhibition like this, there are marketing teams, there are other people involved. The show is called From Here to There, and then there's the subtitle.
Yes, Alex Soth's America.
Yep.
But this is sort of a nod to the fact that many people now see you, and especially with this exhibit, as an official photographer of America, you know, in the tradition of Robert Frank or Joel Sternfeld. And is this what you set out to do or become?
I mean, in the beginning, when I was being educated, I was so profoundly influenced by the American tradition of photography. I mean, there's no avoiding it. I mean, that in that sort of American-centric way, that was my education, and that was what I was inspired by. I am an American photographer. I happen to be, I think, better photographing in America than elsewhere. So, yeah, America is my subject.
Now, your first big work, Sleeping by the Mississippi, is a journey along the Mississippi River, which runs in the middle of the country. And you live in Minneapolis, where you were born, in middle America. Do you get a sense, though, that in some of the attention you're getting, you know, the way you're called an American photographer, that America has almost been waiting for someone like you to come along, an American photographer who is not from L.A. or New York?
Yeah, I mean, I'm proud that boy. I am sounding like Sarah Palin. I'm proud to be an American. No, but there's a part of me that living in the middle is something that I am proud of in a funny way, because it just seems like if the goal is to have a new perspective on things or a different perspective on things, it seems to make sense that you might come from a different place and even stay in that place to continue seeing the world in a slightly different way.
The show has a lot of your work from your two major projects, Sleeping by the Mississippi and Niagara, your exploration of romantic love, naked couples, and empty hotel rooms in Niagara Falls. But we also get to see a lot of work you haven't shown before. One of the series that really grabbed my attention is Single Goth Seek Same. What is this about?
Single Goth Seek Same is a project that I did just recently, just a little short story. You know, I have this interest in people that want to separate themselves from society, but want to be part of society as well. And I had this interest in goth subcultures because it's the ultimate example of people sort of saying out loud, I don't want to be part of regular society. And I was particularly drawn to goths in the South because there's even a further disconnect. They're saying, I don't want to be part of this larger, you know, sort of Christian gentrified culture. And then I surfing around online, I found these goth dating websites and began poking around in that little world and started, you know, reaching out and meeting these different women and then photographing them. And this is really, you know, common practice now to use, you know, Craigslist and tools like this to meet people.
There's one picture in particular I really love. It's called Linda at Brother's Service Station. It's got this goth woman putting gas into her black Mustang on the right. And on the left, you have this laid-back African-American dude who's filling his white pickup truck. And there's all this stuff that's kind of separating them in the middle of the picture, you know, the median, the gas pumps.
Right.
But she's definitely looking at him in this weird way. There's definitely a connection.
Well, it's, you know, I can tell you the story behind that picture, which is, I think it's pretty fascinating because, I go online, go on this goth dating website, and I meet this woman, Linda. And I mean, this is where real life gets more interesting than online. So I meet her and she's a full on goth woman. But she tells me this, that, you know, she lives in New Orleans, and she tells me that she's really attracted to black men, and that she often goes to this very service station called Brothers Service Station to try to pick up men. And this was really interesting to me. These different cultures clashing in real life, but then she's got this online life, this online identity. It's fascinating, complicated, and not necessarily, you know, politically correct or whatever. But it's sort of edgy and alive.
Well, I wasn't expecting that, but I guess it is a good example of, you know, what you always write about photographs and stories, that while pictures are great at suggesting stories, they're not so good at telling them.
Absolutely. I mean, this is my big struggle as a photographer. It's like to tell the story, to not tell the story, to leave these big gaps where viewers can look at the picture and imagine what's going on, or do I really want to flesh it out? And lately I've been doing little experiments where I do. I'll write out the whole story or tell it or what have you.
You're doing a lot of experimentation with stories and pictures online. I already mentioned your blog, but you also use Flickr and Facebook, and you have an amazing Tumblr site where you show off all the photo books that people are sending you, and it's hard not to get jealous of that, by the way. But can you talk about how the internet plays such a major role in your work?
Yeah, I mean, so when I was coming up as a photographer, I was, you know, as we spoke about, I was really, you know, excited about that American tradition, Robert Frank, on the road, all of that. But then here's this new thing, the internet, which, you know, we love all those metaphors of the, you know, what they call it, the information superhighway is what they used to call it. And, but there was this quality when you first got exposed to the web where it's like you're bouncing around, you're surfing, you're wandering online. And there, somehow the idea came to merge that experience, wandering around online, and then do it in the real world. So take the research from web surfing and then go out and follow it up. And really, that's still like a key part of my practice. And the title of the exhibition, From Here to There, is actually refers to web surfing as much as it does to driving around in a car.
Yeah, but I think it's important to make a distinction here, because you're not just a photographer with a website. I mean, what's fascinating about your work and what ties it so much to the present moment is the way you sort of think like the internet. It seems that, you know, you really explored how the internet has completely changed photography.
Well, I think about it a lot, but I don't have answers for it. I mean, I have a real love-hate relationship with the online world.
We all do, you know, Alec.
Yeah, I guess we all do. But I think it's very, while it's a great tool for me and for photographers, it's also really dangerous. I mean, we're, you know, a Magnum photographer once said to me, we're in the business of making iconic images, you know, and sort of making that one great picture. This was the photographer Dennis Stock, you know, made the famous picture of James Dean walking down Times Square, and these sort of, you know, big iconic pictures. And the internet, the flood of images, takes a lot of that power away. And as you're saying, as you're you know, going through Flickr or, you know, these Tumblr sites, just image after image, sometimes that hunger for more is taking away the preciousness of the individual picture.
Speaking of Magnum, you've been a member of this photojournalist collective for a few years now. You wrote early on how it was weird being the only fine artist in the group. But I'm really curious to hear about what you've learned about journalism from being in Magnum.
I'm really uncomfortable calling myself a journalist. I've had moments where I've done jobs and I sort of take on that mantle for a moment. But there is a crisis in photojournalism because, you know, everyone's got a cell phone camera, so people are documenting things all the time. And so what does that leave the professional journalist to do? I mean, I'm uncomfortable being called a documentary photographer in a lot of ways. I mean, I photograph along the Mississippi River, but it's really, it's all about me and my own interests and where the things I want to look at. I'm not documenting, you know, tugboats and any sort of official record of the Mississippi. And that's pretty much everywhere I go, that's the same thing. I'm always wary of like saying, this is, you know, Niagara Falls. It's not. It's my little glimpse at it. So that's what I'm uncomfortable with is pure documentation anymore. Because as I said, all documentation's going on all the time. So it's taking a document over here and a document over there and connecting them and using, you know, your creative resources to make connections between things. That's where sparks are created, and you can get a fresh perspective on the world.
In 2002, the Canadian photographer Naomi Harris was living in Miami. And since she's a nudist, she was spending a lot of time on the nude beach. One day, this older guy she sort of knew, Ron, asked her for a favor. Ron wanted to go to a swingers club called Trapeze, but being a single dude, he couldn't get in, so he asked Naomi to come with him. He wasn't asking her to do anything, he just needed her to get in the door. And Naomi, being a curious type, said yes.
We went to this club. It's in like an abandoned strip mall. Everything else is shut down except for this one club, and then neon red. You just see the word Trapeze. And so we got there early so Ron could give me the lay of the land and show me all the rooms. And he showed me the back room, which is the orgy room, which was basically 8 mismatched mattresses pushed together. And he's always in this. This is going to be awesome. And I'm just like, okay, they need a little decoration here. And the people started coming in, and they all looked like the same people I had been in line behind at the supermarket or the bank earlier that day. Just regular, ordinary people, like your dentist, your accountant, your school nurse, whatever. And the difference is they're all wearing like Hoochie Mama wear and stripper shoes and men in shiny shirts. And they proceed to go to a buffet where there's a big chef with a hat and the white, crispy, you know, chef's clothes. And he's carving up roast beef and serving scalloped potatoes, and everyone's just, myself included, eating. And then 20 minutes later, everyone's going to the back room, and I proceeded to watch all sorts of different sexual acts unfold in front of me, and I'd never seen anything like that before, and I was just fascinated. Partially because, I mean, I had a bit of indigestion at the time, and I just don't understand how anyone could eat, you know, steak and then have group sex, but okay, that was one of the things that I thought was so funny. And I thought about it, and I'm like, no one's gonna believe me when I tell them that at 3 a.m. when I was leaving the club, there was the breakfast buffet out and the naked woman, except for her high heels, getting like, I forget, Danish or whatever, you know? And so I decided there and then that I really wanted to photograph it.
Naomi Harris spent the next 6 years photographing swingers in clubs, festivals, and their homes. Her book, America Swings, has just been published by Toshin. And when I first saw the book, I knew I had to have her on the show. Naomi Harris shows us a USA you have definitely never seen before.
So the first party I decided to photograph was an event called Swingstock, which is basically a 4-day camping and fornication festival. So I contacted them and they said, yeah, sure, come along. So I packed up my tent and my cameras and flew out to Minnesota, got a car and drove to this campsite about an hour and a half away and went to my very first swing party. The picture I'm showing you now is a scene I stumbled upon in the woods where it was this woman, Marty, who I found out afterwards she had done something like, I don't know, she had taken mushrooms all weekend and had something like 50 orgasms over the course of the weekend. You know, here she is in this sex swing that's been propped in the trees. And this woman is helping her husband bring her to orgasm manually, so to speak. And there's a crowd that has come to watch. And, you know, there's the one woman smoking a cigar and drinking a beer. And then another woman just sort of walked over. She's topless and she's brushing her teeth.
It seems to me that right off the bat, you're kind of capturing laid back moments, attitudes. It's not just casual sex, it's casual attitude. These people are into reclining, putting pillows back under them.
They're on holiday. I mean, this is, people have to remember, like, okay, some swingers take it really serious. It's serious business for them. Like, we're going to come, we're going to get laid, we're going to go home. You know, we don't even care about getting names. For other people, it's very much about the social aspect. It's very recreational. It's very much about friendship. A lot of the swingers I've met, they've stopped being friends with vanilla, regular, everyday people. Their friends are other swingers. I guess they feel they have a connection and they understand each other more.
So let's talk about the things that come to mind when I'm watching the woman brushing her teeth and the fat woman and the guy with the beard. They don't just look like the guys and girls at the bank or the dentist office. Right now, we've got all these rallies going on across America, the Tea Party rallies, and it's mostly older white people. And it kind of reminds me of them. And I'm kind of wondering, with this liberal attitude towards sex, what about the rest? How do they see the rest of the world? Were they liberally well-rounded in life?
The statistic for a swinger in America generally is someone who's between the ages of 35 and 55, middle class, middle America, white, liberal in their sexual attitudes, but not in their political views. And this is one thing I found very interesting. I started this project in 2003, photographed it up until the beginning of 2008. So during 2004, the presidential election between Bush and Kerry, I'd be at parties where fights would actually literally break out. There'd be the few people who are very liberal and saying, how could you vote for him? And then there'd be the other people who are like, and it would get to the point where the host would have to step in and say, you got to stop talking politics, leave it alone, leave it out the door. We're here to But I would say most swingers tend to be Republican, actually. I think another thing to look at in the book is how many pictures illustrate how America, an American, this activity is. Sure, this goes on in Europe, but for me, what was really fascinating, like going to a Thanksgiving dinner complete with turkey and pecan pie, and then people having sex. As a Canadian, these are the things that stick out in my mind as what is America? 4th of July parties, you know. What's more American than football, beer, and blowjobs? The picture I'm showing you now are these series of pictures that take place in Des Moines, Iowa. This is in the living room of Paul and Robin. It's a very nice upper-middle-class home. A sofa with three men sitting on it. And three women sitting with their tops off, kneeling down at their feet, and servicing them, so to speak. While all the men in the picture, there's a few other men on the sidelines, are watching the football game. And their poor dog, Buddy, is just lying there with his bone next to them, kind of like, what the hell am I doing here?
See, this is the thing. This dog looks like he knows that something is not right.
Yeah, maybe. Or maybe he's just kind of like, how did I get messed up into this? I also particularly like the fact that there's a crock pot in the background where they have, like, you know, the little mini cocktail weenies and stuff. And that was one thing that I always found amusing at the swinger parties. There was always food. Always food at every party. And never sexy food. Never like sushi or light stuff, like a crudité platter. It was always like chips and dip and pizza and heavy, heavy foods, a lot of meats. And depending also geographically where you were, like when I was in the South, they had, you know, the way the one party had the buffet at 3 a.m. They pulled out their biscuits and gravy. I mean, to me, that's just hilarious to be having biscuits and gravy after a night of sex.
You make America look really ugly. Obese, flabby.
I didn't do anything. This is what America looks like. And I can't help the fact that as a country, exercise and good nutrition and taking better care of yourself is not the top priority. But this is just a cross-section of what America is with their clothes off and having sex with each other. These people, they're 200 pounds overweight, 300 pounds overweight, and in their minds, they are the bomb. They are the sexiest person there, and you can see it. There's a picture I took at one of the very last parties in Texas where this woman has about 7 rolls on her stomach. But the look she's on her back and I'm above her, and the look she's giving me is, I am the sexiest motherfucker in this room. Don't you forget it. And in her mind, she is. And that's what I love about swingers, their confidence, their absolute lack of, I don't want to use the word shame because there's nothing to be shameful of, but these people are there because they're confident in who they are and what they are, and they are just going for it.
It seems that by the sheer fact that people were so comfortable with you photographing them, that they have a very liberal attitude towards being in the open. In other words, not being something hidden.
I think one of the reasons a lot of people allowed me to photograph them is they felt that they were, it was their duty, that they were the ambassadors of swinging, of the lifestyle, if you will. And if they didn't allow me to photograph, how would they get their gospel out? They needed to be out there so they could get other people into the swing world. They want people to know about it. I think the message is that I am you, and you could be me. That there is no type as to what a swinger is. It's not the porn star. It's not, you know, this impossible image of sexuality. It's the soccer mom. It's the regular guy who goes to the factory every day. It's the police officer. It's everybody. A swinger can be anybody, and it can be you. And I think that's why so many people did allow me to photograph them, because they wanted to show that, you know, I may look plain to you on the outside, but this is my life. You go home every day to your wife. I go to a party on the weekend and I have 5 guys' wives.
For the past month, I've been stuck in France, but it hasn't been a total wash. I have had many opportunities to hunt for photography books, and I've picked up a few real gems from my collection, but sadly, my best find slipped right through my fingers. I was in Chalon-sur-Saône, I took the train from Paris to see the birthplace of photography. This is where, in 1826, Nicéphore Nieps took his first successful permanent photograph, view from the window at Le Gras. Nicéphore Nieps focused a camera obscura out his window. He took an 8-hour exposure, so sunlight illuminates the buildings on both sides. He called his process heliography, but it was one of the first examples of what we now call photography. When I arrived at the house on the outskirts of town, everything was closed, but there was a map on a sign marking exactly where Nicéphore Nieps aimed his magic box. But it didn't look the same, and there was no sunlight. There is a larger museum in Salon-sur-Saône, but when I arrived at 1 p.m., they were closing up for lunch. I pretended not to understand and bum-rushed the stairs. Sure enough, his old camera obscura was on display on the second floor. It didn't look like much, though. Just a plain old wooden box, almost as big as a coffin. A woman chased up after me. "Excuse me," she said in perfect English. "The museum is closing now. You have to leave." Chastised, I followed her down the stairs. She was very beautiful. I asked her if there were any photography bookstores in town that she could recommend. "No," she said, "none that I can think of. But there is an auction house, and today they will probably be auctioning off many photo-related items." She started to draw me a map, but then she crumpled up the piece of paper and threw it on the floor. "I'll just take you," she said. Her eyes sparkled. We got into her car. It was not that far, maybe a 10-minute drive. They were not closed for lunch. In fact, there was an auction starting up just as we sat down. We watched about 5 lots get gaveled away, and then, before my eyes, the auctioneer presented an original 19th century maquette produced by the photographer Constant Famat. Constant Famat is famous for the photographs of trees he took in the forest of Fontainebleau in the 1860s. But what many people don't realize is that by the time he got to Fontainebleau, the forest was already a tourist trap. And while he did his best to present nature unsullied by man, the forest was in truth overflowing with litter and detritus. But in this little 30-page maquette, Famat presents us with evidence of vandals and summer hooligans. All the trees in this book bore carvings, mutilations, and other humiliations. But to my even greater surprise, the auctioneer opened up the bidding for this item at 1,000 euros. I raised my paddle with a shout. This would, of course, ruin me, but it would be worth it. Plus, my new companion was impressed with my bravado. I guess she liked that I was impulsive with money. But then I realized to my horror that the auctioneer had actually said 10,000 euros, not 1,000 euros. My heart sank. This would go way beyond ruination. This would mean jail. Finally, a few other paddles went up, and the price rose to 12,000 euros. Relieved, I put my paddle underneath my feet and slunk in my chair. My companion was no longer impressed, and her eyes stopped sparkling. She didn't even say anything when we drove back to town. I got out at the train station and went directly back to Paris. I had much better luck in Paris. Tons of cheap books in the hipster shops in the Bastille area. Many great new finds, including 2 photo books that draw from Google Street View. The best one, from Germany, showcases crimes and violence, all captured by Google cameras. But the Danish book, that shows people all over the world giving Google the finger, is pretty great too. I also found a brand new photo book of portraits of members from Anonymous and Lull Security and other hacker groups in the news. Everyone is in there, even the right-wing guys like the Jester and the A-Team. But my favorite new book I found in Montmartre. I was walking to a party when I happened upon a bunch of people mulling about on the sidewalk. And since they were all nicely dressed and holding flutes of champagne, I assumed that this was an art opening. And inside, there were in fact tables with cheese and fruit. There was even a live band playing in the corner. Okay, the band was really bad. It was a fake soft jazz combo. That should have been a clue that something was amiss, but as soon as I walked into the room, I was overcome by the photos. The walls were covered with these giant photos of ruined apartments. And these were glorious romantic bohemian apartments. There were obvious signs that these apartments once belonged to great artists, writers, and musicians. They all looked hastily abandoned, and there was an air of mystery and sadness. I looked around the room for the artist, and then it hit me. This was not an art gallery. This is a real estate office. The fake jazz and the flutes of champagne should have made it clear. This was not a happening. It was a celebration for the first phase of a rehab project. Everyone here was purchasing a condo, and the images on the walls marked the before stage. In fact, there were drawings on the wall as well, detailing what these glorious ruins would one day become. There was a binder on the cheese table that contained all the photos. Now, I have a lot of photo books on ruins. It's one of my favorite genres, so there was just no way I could leave it there. So, when no one was looking, I stuffed it in my pants. It is an amazing book. A wonderful addition to my library. And don't forget, if you ever want to come over and check out my library, drop me a line. As I've said before, you are welcome anytime. This episode of Too Much Information is called Photo Op. It was produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, with Bill Bowen. It featured Steve Pike, Richard Mizrach, Alex Soth, and Naomi Harris. Special thanks to the people of France. On the TMI show page, you can find links to all the photographers I discussed in the show, and you can subscribe to the TMI podcast as well. All that at WFMU.org.
Join us next week at the same time for another edition of Too Much Information. You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, WFMU.org. Up now, For the Record with Dave Emery.
Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 746, Greek Tragedy, being recorded on June 19th of the year 2011. Happy Father's Day to people out there. Also, happy Juneteenth to people out there. Let me stress at the beginning of this broadcast that, again, using the website, using the SpitfireList.com website, will not only enhance your understanding of these broadcasts, but at this point I think is all but essential to a complete understanding of the program. One of the many things offered on that website is the very important GermanForeignPolicy.com newsletter. It is fed along the bottom of the front page of the website, along with Global Muslim Brotherhood Daily Report and Lucy Commissar's remarkable work on offshore. And we are going to be relying on GermanForeignPolicy.com for a nice chunk of the program today. This broadcast, as indicated by the title, is going to be dealing with the Greek economic crisis. And we're going to be basically taking a look at what has taken place, what isn't taking place, what people are talking about doing, what shouldn't be done. And the purpose of this is not only to understand Greece and the European Economic Union, but a lot of people, in particular the GOP writer, saying that if we don't have massive slashing of this, that, and the other thing, then we're going to wind up like Greece. And in fact, Greece is a very, very different state of affairs than the United States. Also, although we probably won't have time to discuss it in detail in this program, Wolfgang Schäuble has intimated that the United States needs to change its economic policies in order to basically avoid becoming a moribund economy like Greece. And in fact, there do have to be some changes to the U.S. economy. But what he's talking about is something that would not benefit the United States, but would benefit Germany. Perhaps we'll have time for that in this broadcast, perhaps not. We are going to be dealing at some point in the not-too-distant future with PIMCO. That is the largest bond trader in the world. It's also a wholly owned subsidiary of Allianz, the German insurance company that, among other things, is the defendant in a number of lawsuits, or has been the defendant in a number of lawsuits relating to their behavior during World War II, when they were complicit with the appropriation or, quote, Aryanization of the property of Jews and others who were liquidated in the Holocaust and during the Third Reich's depredations. We're going to plunge right in. And again, the reason we're going into the Greek tragedy is because we are being told that the same thing is going to happen to the U.S., and in particular, the GOP right, which is pretty much redundant these days, is threatening, well, if we, they're not going to raise the debt limit, the debt ceiling unless this, that, and the other thing happens. That will, whew, that will destroy not only the U.S., but the global economy. And well, it's something that the GOP right might just do if Obama doesn't kowtow to them, as he generally has been in the past, and as I expect him to do in the not-too-distant future. But we're going to take a look at the Greek tragedy, because the Greek tragedy may become an American tragedy down the line. We're going to begin by taking a look at the GermanForeignPolicy.com issue of 323, March 23rd of 2011. This is titled From the Crisis into the Crisis. It's datelined Athens and Berlin. And one of the things to note here is that one of the things that is ailing Greece is what is known to economists as a deflationary spiral. That is also what the U.S. may very well be experiencing. Time permitting, we'll get into that later. But I also want to note that not only has Germany been the greatest beneficiary of the Greek economic malaise, but also if Greece should default on its bonds, if Greek debt is subject to default, German and French banks are those who are most exposed. It will ultimately wind up causing chaos around the world, including in the United States. But first, let's take a look at what is going on in Greece and what is not going on in Greece. From March 23rd of 2011, the GermanForeignPolicy.com newsletter, From the Crisis into the Crisis. In the run-up to decisions to be taken at the EU summit to begin tomorrow in Brussels, Greek economic development shows the euro crisis management in a miserable light. Athens, which since last year has been strictly applying the austerity programs being demanded mainly by Berlin, has been regularly confronted with popular protests. Journalists and employees of the local public transportation system in Athens went on strike just last week. The cuts in wages and public spending are driving the country ever deeper into the recession. Just taking the period from the first to the third quarter of 2010, the period from the beginning of EU crisis intervention to its first effects, the rate of shrinkage of the Greek national economy increased from 0.7 to 5.7%. Simultaneously, unemployment increased significantly. There is a disastrous development of the national debt. Because of its enormous proportions, about 125% of the gross domestic product, Berlin and Brussels have imposed austerity measures. The crisis measures modeled on Germany are forcing up the national debt to nearly 150% of the gross domestic product. How this is supposed to stabilize Greece and the euro is a mystery. The Greek crisis was most recently on the agenda of the March 10th EU summit. At that meeting, Greece was able to extract a relaxation of the conditions for the emergency credit needed to avoid national bankruptcy in 2010. The crisis credit provided Athens by the EU and the IMF amounted to 110 billion euros. Brussels prolonged the period of repayment from 3 to 7.5 years. Athens, in addition, was able to negotiate a reduction of 1% in the interest rate, down to 5%. Thanks to these more advantageous conditions, Greece will be able to save 6 billion euros, declared Greece's Prime Minister, George Papandreou. As always, Brussels concessions came with strings attached. Athens had to obligate itself to impose even more austerity measures and extensive privatizations, demands raised repeatedly, especially by Berlin. On the eve of the Brussels summit, Chancellor Angela Merkel laid out to the Europe Committee of the German Bundestag under which conditions Berlin would be in agreement to grant German support, unquote, to Greece. Athens would have to sell public property and undertake extensive privatizations if it is to be granted a lower interest rate for its EU credit.